Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group is hosting a discussion on the case National Cotton Council versus EPA and the significance of the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, or NPDES permits, under the Clean Water Act. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. My name is Douglas Nelson. I'm Executive Vice President and General Counsel of CropLife America, a non-for-profit trade association representing the nation's developers, manufacturers, formulators, and distributors of plant science solutions for agriculture and pest management in the United States. Our member companies produce, sell, and distribute virtually all the crop protection technology products used by American farmers. Before we begin, let's take a little time to look at the background of this very significant case out of the Sixth Circuit. The Clean Water Act requires an NPDES permit in order to discharge pollutants from point sources into waters of the United States. In the past, EPA has not required an NPDES permit to apply pesticides, which are registered to serve a beneficial purpose under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFRA, since they didn't meet one or more of the Clean Water Act requirements under the EPA's analysis. They were not a point source discharge, nor a pollutant. However, several legal challenges overturned this approach in the recent history. In 2001, a decision termed Headwaters, Inc. versus Talent Irrigation District, the Ninth Circuit held that aquatic herbicide residue left in water from pesticide applications was a chemical waste and thus a pollutant, requiring a permit under the Clean Water Act. The following year, in the League of Wilderness Defenders versus Forsgren, the Ninth Circuit again held that the application of insecticides to a forest canopy over the waters of the U.S. constituted a point source discharge, again requiring thus an NPDES permit. The only slight revision of this came in 2005 in the Fairhurst versus Hagener decision, in which the Ninth Circuit held that pesticides that are intentionally applied to nation's waters in compliance with FIFRA, but that produce no residue or unintended effects are not pollutants requiring a Clean Water Act NPDES permit. In responses to this uncertainty, EPA issued an interpretive statement, a proposed rule, and ultimately a final rule to clarify and codify its interpretation that the application of pesticides under at least two circumstances would not require an NPDES permit. Specifically, those two circumstances are, one, applying pesticides directly to water in order to control pests, or two, applying pesticides to control pests that are present over water, including near water, where a portion of the pesticide will unavoidably be deposited into the waters. EPA argued that its rule was based on its longstanding policy that pesticides being used for their intended purpose and according to all relevant federal label restrictions are not Clean Water Act pollutants and thus did not require NPDES permits. As you can imagine, this caused some controversy. 11 environmental groups, 11 industry groups, subsequently challenged EPA's final rule in 11 of the circuits throughout the United States, filing 8 industry petitions and 3 environmentalist petitions. The cases were consolidated, assigned to the Sixth Circuit, and the name was given National Cotton Council versus EPA. The court decided in its decision just this year that the Clean Water Act definition of a pollutant, which includes in the Act itself the terms chemical waste and biological material, unambiguously includes any excess or residual chemical pesticide and any biological pesticide. The court observed that there are at least two situations in which excess or residual chemical pesticide would meet the Clean Water Act definition of chemical waste. One, where the chemical pesticides are applied to land or air, an excess pesticide or pesticide residue ultimately finds its way into jurisdictional waters. And secondly, where the residue remains after a chemical pesticide has been directly applied to jurisdictional waters and has completed its intended purpose. On this basis, the court concluded that applying chemical pesticides to waters is a pollutant unless the pesticide leaves no excess portion after performing its intended purpose. The court also decided that the term biological materials within the pollutant definition unambiguously includes all biological pesticides and their residue. Court ultimately concluded that the application of biological pesticides to waters involves a pollutant under all circumstances. And finally, the court rejected EPA's interpretation that excess and residual chemical pesticides should be excluded from NPDES permitting requirements because the pesticides do not qualify as pollutants at the time of discharge from a point source. The court found, and I quote, "There is no requirement that the discharge chemical or other substance immediately cause harm to be considered as coming from a point source. Rather, the requirement is that the discharge come from a discernible, confined, discrete conveyance, which is the case for pesticide applications," end quote. Thus, the court found that EPA's attempt to inject a temporal requirement for the discharge of pollutants into the water was contrary to the plain language of the Clean Water Act. Accordingly, the court vacated EPA's final rule, and the court did not analyze any arguments addressing the relationship between the Clean Water Act and FIFRA. Following this decision of the Sixth Circuit, applicators or landowners will generally need an NPDES permit to apply pesticides into or over, including near, water. The Sixth Circuit granted EPA's request for a 2-year stay of the mandate to give EPA time to propose and implement a permitting system. Intervenor respondents, in which I have to include CropLife as one, requested a full rehearing by the full Sixth Circuit, but that was denied on August 3rd. We are very privileged to have with us today on this Federalist podcast two counsel who were actively involved in this litigation. Ellen Steen of Crowell & Mooring, counsel for the American Farm Bureau Federation and the American Forest and Paper Association, and Charles Tebbett of the Western Environmental Law Center, counsel for Baykeeper, Californians for Alternates to Toxics, California Sport Fishing Protection Alliance, the National Center for Conservation Science and Policy, Oregon Wild, and St. John's Organic Farm. We'll begin by going to Ellen Steen. Ellen Steen is a partner at Crowell & Mooring. That's a major international law firm headquartered primarily in D.C. She is resident in the D.C. office and specializes in environmental and natural resources law. She has represented a broad range of industrial, mining, timber, and agricultural clients in matters involving the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, Superfund, RCRA, EPRA, TSCA, FIFRA, and NEPA. Ellen's litigation practice has included a wide range of cases concerning the scope of EPA's regulatory authority, both challenging and defending EPA regulations, as well as enforcement actions by EPA and Citizen Group. I'll turn it now to Ellen Steen of Crowell & Mooring, after which we will then go to Charles Tebbett. Ellen?
Thank you, Doug, and thanks for having me here. I guess I'd begin by saying that there are two aspects of this case that that to me I think are especially interesting and will be to many people listening, and they're quite different. One is sort of a practical point about the impact of the decision on the NPDES permitting program. This case will dramatically expand, maybe double, maybe a lot more than double, the number of people and businesses that are going to need coverage under NPDES permits. And it raises a host of issues. That expansion alone raises a host of issues for the agencies that have to write permits and for the people and businesses that rely on pesticides. Also, purely from an administrative law perspective, the case raises very interesting issues about what type of analysis is necessary or should be necessary for a court to override an agency regulation. What level of analysis is sufficient for a court to find a statute so clear that the court can overturn a different interpretation that's been codified in an agency rule? In this case, we have a court vacating an agency rule on the basis of statutory provisions and legislative history that contain absolutely no mention of the question at issue, which is whether the application of a pesticide is a, quote, discharge of a pollutant under the statute. When the text of a statute allows for more than one reading, which in this case we submit the Clean Water Act does, we believe that Chevron requires a court to point to some evidence that Congress considered the issue and intended a certain result. Otherwise, the court must acknowledge the ambiguity in the statute and defer to any reasonable agency interpretation. Now, so I'll step back for a few minutes and just talk about each of these two aspects of the decision that make it important, and back up to the practical one, the scope of the NPDES permitting program and how this decision will change it. The NPDES program has historically regulated mostly industrial wastewater discharges since it was established in the 1970s. As a result of some amendments in the later part of the 1980s, beginning in the 1990s, certain stormwater discharges have also been regulated, industrial stormwater discharges, municipal stormwater systems, stormwater from construction activities, and so on. That expansion of the program required EPA to develop a regulation allowing the issuance of something called general permits. This was a product of EPA's rulemaking to come up with a mechanism for permitting such a large number of activities when the agency had to expand the program to cover stormwater discharges. In recent years, there were roughly 400,000 permittees covered under the entire NPDES permitting program. About 350,000 permittees were covered under general permits. Most of those were stormwater discharges. And about 45,000 discharges covered under individual permits. Most of those were industrial wastewater discharges. Based on a very narrow construction of the Sixth Circuit's ruling in this case, EPA has now identified a list of pesticide use patterns that are going to require permitting under the NPDES program. Things like mosquito spray, mosquito larvicides, which are applied directly into water, ditch weed control, forest canopy spray to prevent a pest outbreak in a forest, that sort of thing. Estimating the number of these applications that will occur annually, EPA projects that this permit requirement will now apply to roughly 5.6 million pesticide applications annually. Compare that to 400,000 permittees under the program previously, and you see how dramatic this expansion is. And EPA and the states, 46 NPDES authorized states who write these permits, will be grappling with this for the next year, and I would hazard a guess and say a lot longer than a year, how to make this work to have this program expand so dramatically and cover such a tremendous number and diversity of activities. And that brings me to point number two, which is this explosion in the scope of the program is entirely unnecessary, because when this brings it to the administrative law side of this, Congress never dreamed in 1972, let alone intended, that NPDES permits would be required for the use of pesticides. In more than 35 years of administering the Clean Water Act, EPA never interpreted the statute to regulate pesticide use, and never issued an NPDES permit for pesticide use. It would seem that no one thought of this until about 25 years after the statute was enacted, when the citizen suit litigation began. Now, in the context of all this, the court found that although EPA never saw it before in all these years, the plain language of the Clean Water Act required the regulation of the application of pesticides as the, quote, discharge of a pollutant. And the court made this finding even though it also found that most pesticides, which is to say chemical pesticides, are not pollutants when they're being used for their intended purpose. In other words, the pesticide that's being applied is not a pollutant, and the court found as much, but also found that, as EPA had found, that excess or residual pesticide after the application is a pollutant. So the court found essentially that the plain language of the Clean Water Act requires the regulation of the discharge of any product that will become a pollutant, rather than what the text of the statute says, which is that it covers the discharge of a pollutant. The court drew its conclusion based on general statements of statutory purposes, the broad Clean Water Act objective to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. That's the objective that's set out in the statute. But that type of statement of purpose is simply not sufficient under Chevron to overcome ambiguity in the operative text. And I think that most people would agree that when you use phrases like discharge of a pollutant, it's at least reasonable to read that to refer to the discharge of a substance that is a pollutant when it's discharged. Not the discharge of a substance that may or even will become a pollutant in the future. Now, if the court can look to general statements of purpose like this and use that to resolve ambiguity in the operative text, then all a court any time has to do is to look to general goals and form its own conclusions as to what best serves those purposes. In other words, I think it completely eviscerates what Chevron and the Chevron line of cases set out to do in terms of allowing agencies to fill gaps left by Congress and not the courts, at least in the context of a formal agency rulemaking.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ellen. And now let's turn to the other side. Charles Tebbit is an attorney from Eugene, Oregon, who's been working with the Western Environmental Law Center since 1994. Charlie has been among the most active citizen enforcement attorneys in the United States, having been involved in scores of enforcement action against major polluters in some 20 states, using primarily the Clean Water Act, EPRA, the Clean Air Act, and RCRA. He has worked with grassroots citizen enforcers to leverage innovative pollution prevention settlements in dozens of cases. And most recently, he's been working to protect the waters of the West, bringing accountability to concentrated animal feeding operations. And some of his work will be featured in an upcoming book entitled Animal Factory. He was lead counsel for the environmental plaintiffs in the National Cotton Council versus EPA. Charlie graduated with a BA in sociology from SUNY Albany in 1979 and received his JD from Syracuse University in 1987. He has practiced in five federal circuit courts of appeal. I introduce Charlie Tebbit. Charlie?
Thank you, Doug, and thank you, Ellen, for the introduction. But what I'd like to talk to you all about today is what the permitting from the result of this case decision will accomplish. And first of all, it's going to accomplish accountability that's historically been lacking with pesticide applications. We've had an historic overuse of pesticides in this country where we've relied on pesticides for a first resort use rather than a last resort use, which is really what is most necessary. So why is this important? Why should pesticides be more regulated? The reasons are many, but primarily persistence. The pesticides and chemicals that we use persist in our environment. They persist in the water columns, the sediments, the fish and wildlife that depend on those aquatic resources, and they also bioaccumulate and affect humans. When we consume fish, when we consume wildlife that are affected by these pesticides, they accumulate in our bodies. As found in recent studies, hundreds of chemicals are found in our bodies, many of them pesticides. What are the effects of these chemicals? We don't know fully. Because there have been no systems to test the synergistic effects of these chemicals on humans and wildlife. We do know that there are subacute effects from chemicals. Many of the pesticides are hormone mimickers that create havoc with our endocrine system, feminizing males and masculinizing females. And then, of course, there are acute effects such as neurotoxicity, cancer, and other effects. So why is this decision, once again, important? And is this, as Ellen said, an unnecessary duplication of regulation? And we, of course, would answer no, that it's not. FIFRA and the Clean Water Act are two very different statutes. FIFRA is primarily a registration statute to get a pesticide out into commerce. And again, FIFRA was set up many, many years ago to deal with the overwhelming number of chemicals that were coming onto the market. Has it done a sufficient job? That's for another debate, but we can certainly dabble in some of that discussion today. But the Clean Water Act is intended to deal with site-specific applications and site-specific problems. But before we go into that, let's look at what the overall goal of the Clean Water Act is. And the overall goal originally was to eliminate pollution into our nation's waters by 1983. In 1977, that was amended to say 1985. So, again, the overall goal, elimination of the pollution of our nation's waters by 1985. It's 24 years later. Our nation's waters are still heavily polluted. Some say they are now fishable and swimmable, but that fishable definition is something that we have to look at closely because, yes, you might be able to see fish or catch fish in there, but you're not supposed to eat them most of the time. And a lot of those, again, are the result of past chemical uses and ongoing chemical uses, including the ubiquitous use of pesticides in our country. So, again, the Clean Water Act is a very site-specific type of analysis that is unavailable by FIFRA. FIFRA is a general registration statute. So with that said, a little bit of background. We have to recognize that the EPA rule in response to the Headwaters case and the League of Wilderness Defenders case that Doug referenced earlier that was challenged here in National Cotton Council did not appear spontaneously and out of nowhere. It was the direct result of efforts by the pesticide industry to override the Headwaters and the League of Wilderness Defenders decisions by going to Washington to either get Congress to override the victory in Headwaters or get a rule in place. And obviously, the Clean Water Act is a bedrock statute that is very difficult and hopefully impossible to overturn in Congress. So the pesticide industry found some sympathetic ears in the Bush EPA to figure out a way to undo the Headwaters decision. And that came as a result of both a petition from the American Mosquito Control Association and a white paper from Latham and Watkins back in 2003. And this was after one of the attorneys for the purveyor of the chemical at issue in the Headwaters case came to my office and said to me directly, if you don't withdraw your victory, and I still don't know what withdraw victory means to this day, we'll go to Washington and get it overturned. And perhaps a little flippantly, I said, well, thanks for coming by. Send me a postcard and let me know how you're doing. And the postcard came in the form of EPA's proposed rulemaking and later the November 2006 rule that was challenged. But again, I think, again, we have to look at what the goals of this decision or the implications of this decision mean in the context of the Clean Water Act. Going back to some of what Ellen said, her argument that the plain language of the Clean Water Act never intended pesticides to be swept into the ambit of the Clean Water Act. We obviously challenged directly in the Sixth Circuit. One of the most conservative circuits in the country agreed with us and has agreed with us by denying the industry's petition for rehearing as well. But these are very important points that, again, it's the plain language of the statute that requires that pesticides that leave residues be considered pollutants under the Clean Water Act, and they certainly are. We can go back to, for instance, the example of DDT, and we're still finding it in the environment in the form of DDE and other metabolites that are very toxic to humans and wildlife. Atrazine is another example where EPA has admitted that the metabolites of atrazine are just as toxic as atrazine itself. These applications of pesticides have implications for us presently and in the future. And the Clean Water Act is perhaps the only mechanism that can deal with that. FIFRA certainly does not and cannot. And so I'd like to just talk about a couple of examples where the permitting system can actually have an important effect on perhaps obviating the need for permits altogether. And one example is in the Headwaters versus Talent Irrigation District case. Since 2001, Talent Irrigation District has not used any aquatic herbicides. It has found mechanical means to eliminate the weeds and algae that build up in its irrigation system, for which the chemical acrolein was used in the first place. If we can eliminate, if we can be smart and look at the front-end use of why or what we need to do in the first place to deal with the issue, rather than going directly to a chemical approach, there are systems that can work in balance with both the needs of, I'll say the user here in this case, or the grower perhaps, or the irrigation district, to figure out a way that's more consistent, more environmentally sound, more environmentally sustainable. And so they have done that. They have obviated or eliminated the need for an NPDES permit by going to the mechanical means. Secondly, in another situation, St. John's Organic Farm versus the Gem County Mosquito Abatement District case, that was a situation where aerial applications of adulticides were used as well as truck fogging. And they were truck fogging and aerially applying right over waters of the United States. And that settlement of that case resulted in the elimination of aerial spraying and the buffers from truck fogging around waterways, because the efficacy of adulticiding is found to be very minimal in the first place. It's much more important to look at eliminating habitat and taking other measures such as more effective larvaciding to eliminate adult mosquitoes rather than trying to kill them in the air when the efficacy of that can be very, very low. So with that said, I think Ellen discussed and Doug discussed the elements of the National Cotton Council case. It's not a long decision. It's based strictly on statutory interpretation and the Chevron step one analysis, not a step two analysis. It's a step one analysis where the statute is unambiguous, that the courts have the duty to implement the unambiguous intent of Congress. And that's what happened here. EPA tried to get around that by creating, by fabricating a definition that would eliminate, or fabricate a definition that would, that essentially said that a point source discharge is a non-point source discharge for purposes of the Clean Water Act. And that interpretation was absurd on its face, and the court found that it was absurd on its face, that clearly the pesticide came from a point source, that it had wastes and residuals associated with it is what brought it under the ambit of the chemical waste definition under the Clean Water Act. And so I'll stop there for now and look forward to questions and discussion.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Why don't we give each of you the opportunity to respond to each other? And because I think, Charlie, you've raised some very interesting issues, obviously the interplay between both FIFRA and Clean Water Act, and the whole definition issue at the end of whether or not a discharge of a pollutant that, as Ellen said, is not a pollutant at the time it's discharged, whether that still is then deemed to be a pollutant and needing an NPDES permit under the Clean Water Act. Ellen, if you would like the first opportunity to respond to anything that Charlie said and also add anything more to your comments, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I will do that, Doug. I guess I would first just respond to the point that EPA's rule was, I can't remember what the words were, tortured and ridiculous on its face or something to that effect, and a fabrication. There are two aspects of this, and this deals with one, which is the words of the statute, the text that is in the statute, and whether it is capable of supporting more than one reading. The words that we have here are discharge of a pollutant, which is a defined term, defined to mean the addition of a pollutant to waters of the U.S. from a point source, and all of those elements are part of what it takes to make a discharge of a pollutant under the statute. And that is the thing, and that is the only thing that's regulated through NPDES permits. The Clean Water Act has lots of other programs and vehicles for dealing with other sources of pollution, but in terms of the NPDES permitting program, it deals with the discharge of a pollutant from a point source. Now, we may disagree, and we clearly do, about which is the preferable interpretation of that phrase, but to me, at least, and I think to many others, it is not ridiculous on its face to suggest that the discharge of a pollutant from a point source means that the thing at issue is a pollutant at the time it comes from the point source. In our rehearing petition, we use the analogy that you don't squeeze butter from a cow, you squeeze milk from a cow. Now milk may become butter in the future, but you don't squeeze butter from a cow. Similarly, you don't discharge pollutant from a pesticide application device if the product in it is, at this time, a useful product and not a pollutant, even though we would all recognize that there are certainly products that become pollutants in the environment after their application. And again, no one is saying that that is an issue that ought not be dealt with. The question is, ought it be dealt with through the NPDES permitting requirement? I would say no, and I would say that on the basis of other tools for construction that we have available beyond those terms. One is the legislative history and the context for the enactment of this program. Congress was plainly aware of and discussed pesticide use as a source of water pollution at the time that it enacted the provisions we're talking about. But the discussion that you see when you look at the legislative history is all in the context of dealing with non-point source pollution. There was no discussion of whether pesticide use might also be dealt with through the NPDES permitting program. And to me, what's ridiculous is the suggestion that Congress would have done such a thing with no discussion. It's inconceivable that Congress would have intended to regulate the use of pesticides in the environment for mosquito control or agricultural purposes or backyard weed and feed through NPDES permitting without discussing it. And there are two reasons that's ridiculous. One is the highly punitive and prescriptive nature of this permitting program, which has penalties, and I think originally they were $25,000 per day per violation, and now they're $37,500 per violation for the use of a pesticide without a permit. And the permitting process itself that was set up was extremely rigorous, with public participation for permit coverage, the imposition of effluent limitations in the permit that would be aimed at rigorous technology-based standards to control the amount of pollutant in the discharge. This is a rigorous, stringent permitting program. And yet we see that at the time that Congress was enacting this program, it was simultaneously considering and enacted the very same year a very different program to regulate pesticide use. In 1972, Congress enacted what was called the Federal Environmental Pesticide Control Act of 1972, which was a major set of amendments to the FIFRA statute that called on EPA to assess the environmental effects of pesticides, to deny registration, and thereby prohibit the sale and distribution of pesticides with unreasonable adverse effects on the environment, and also to regulate pesticide use through the approval of enforceable pesticide label restrictions. Now, no one is suggesting, and we've been accused of suggesting, that either of these statutes cancels each other out. What we are suggesting is that this other scheme that Congress considered and adopted simultaneously with the enactment of the point source permitting program for pollutant discharges demonstrates that Congress never envisioned that the point source permitting program for pollutant discharges would apply to pesticide use. It is inconceivable that they would have gone through these two different programs that were both intended to apply to pesticide use without discussing the fact in some legislative debate on either of the statutes. So I think it's important to step back and just keep common sense in mind. And what did Congress intend?
Charlie, do you need some time for rebuttal?
Just a few things, yes. Thanks, Doug. And the first is that the legislative history of the Clean Water Act does have many references to the use of pesticides and the concerns about pesticides on water quality. Senator Dole discussed it, Senator Muskie discussed it, and many others discussed it as well. So to say that the legislative history doesn't discuss pesticides or concern about it is
not... Oh, but
is
that's not what I said. You're making my point.
Just a minute. Let me finish, please. While it doesn't get to the direct issue of permitting, it does discuss the overall issue of permitting, and as the court recognized, it says that where a point source can be limited, it should be, and it should be, and it must be through the NPDES system, because any discharge of a pollutant other than through a permit is illegal. And so the issue is, and as Ellen said, is it a pollutant at the time of discharge? And as EPA said back in 1999 in the Headwaters amicus brief, it said EPA approves pesticides under FIFRA with the knowledge that pesticides containing pollutants may be discharged from point sources into the navigable waters only pursuant to a properly issued Clean Water Act permit, end quote. And so there's two issues here. What Ellen says, and I think where you're wrong, Ellen, is that there is waste at the time of discharge. Excess material that misses its target is by definition waste, as the court recognized. And that residual that is left after application and misses its target site is also a pollutant. And so for you to, the analogy, and I still don't quite understand the don't squeeze butter from a cow thing, but in this situation, if the milk from the cow misses the bucket and it goes into the waterways, then it's a pollutant. And that's the problem here. It's not that you're getting butter from the cow. It's that you're getting the milk and the residuals from the cow that are causing the pollution. So, again, as you discussed, the Clean Water Act is supposed to be technology-based and technology-forcing. But let's look at the practical and common sense aspects of pesticide use in the first place, because that's the right technology. That pollution continues, as the Clean Water Act legislative history says, is a function of technological limitations, not because of an inherent right to use our waterways to discharge pollution. So let's look at ending the pollution up front. Let's look at other mechanisms, integrated pest management, and other alternatives to pesticide use that can limit the pesticide pollution of our nation's waters, our fish and wildlife, and our own bodies.
You raise an interesting debate and a good philosophical debate about whether man should be using pesticides in the environment, chemicals in the environment, whether we should use fertilizers on our lawns, whether we should wash our cars out of doors and allow the the soap to run off into the streams, and all of those things may very well be subject to regulation under the NPDES program if we head in the direction that this court's opinion would take us. But I think that that the philosophical questions that you're raising about whether all of this comes down to technology or whether it simply relates to the fact that man is a creature who engages in activities that will generate pollutants. We use things that will generate pollutants in the environment. And I believe that if Congress had intended to regulate back at its original source every activity that ultimately is a but-for cause of pollutants in the environment, and that's what the broad reasoning of the court would suggest, and what I think I just heard you suggest, that's not at all what Congress had in mind. I think that if they had that in mind, they would have said something along those lines. To have the NPDES program, for example, regulate all sources of pollution. They use terms of art. The question before the court is whether those terms of art are susceptible of more than one meaning. If they are, then we come back to the fundamental question, which is, what is the role of the court faced with that ambiguity? I think the court overstepped, and obviously we disagree, based on the court's view.
Yes, and
perhaps
you disagree both with me.
Disagreement with, I'm sorry?
Go ahead, sorry.
The court overstepped by ignoring ambiguity in the plain text in favor of the broad principles, the ultimate objective of protecting waters. That I think Chevron doesn't permit, and I think if it did, I think it's meaningless.
Well, I don't think the court did go that far. The court looked at the plain language of the statute, and in interpreting what the plain language of the statute meant, it did also look at the overall goals, as the Supreme Court suggests and actually requires that the courts do, both in Milwaukee versus Illinois and International Paper versus Willett, among other cases. So there is ample precedent in that regard, that the court is to look at the overall purpose of the statute in interpreting meaning.
With that thinking, I'm sorry.
Well, and the court did first of all look to the plain language of what chemical waste is, the term waste, and it went to various definitions, both in Black's dictionary as well as the American Heritage Dictionary and Webster's, and they all came up with the same conclusion, that excess material and residuals constitute waste, and that's exactly the basis of this court's holding.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that when they went through that analysis, they agreed with EPA's interpretation that the pesticide in use is not, at least with respect to chemical pesticides, which is the vast majority of pesticides out there, is not a pesticide, is not a pollutant, is not a chemical waste. The court agreed, as I read the opinion, that the excess or residual comes into existence after the point of its release from the application equipment. We're into this issue, though, that's sort of angels dancing on a head of a pin, whether the substance that comes out of the application equipment that is a product at that time, but that everyone may recognize at some point during its, as it travels through the air, some of it will miss a target, and some of it will become, quote, excess. The point is that all of it, at the moment of its release from the application equipment, is being released to control a pest, to accomplish what at least, in the views of many of us, is a good. It is its intended purpose, at least. And it is not the fact that it may become a pollutant in the future. You get back to this, whether it has to be a pollutant at the time it comes from the point source or not, and that's something that I don't think can be resolved on the basis of those words, which is why the court had to turn to the broader goals and rely on that to reach its results. And that coming to that, I have to ask you, what, with this type of analysis, would distinguish, for example, the use of fertilizers?
Well, Ellen, first of all, let me say that I disagree with your interpretation of the court's ruling. The court did say that there is waste that comes from the point source application immediately, where there is excess, and that comes from point source at the time it's discharged, it's a waste. And the excess misses the target. And by design, a lot of these pesticides are by design known not to hit their target, you know, with 100% of the pesticide. 10, 20, as much as 90 or 95% of the pesticide is known to miss its target. So therefore, it becomes a waste immediately. So that's one issue. As for fertilizers, I'm not sure the positive of your question is specific enough for me to answer, but I can say in this context that Congress did create an exemption for agricultural stormwater runoff. And so the fertilizers, if you will, that are used in the farming industry, so long as they are applied at agronomic rates, are exempt from the Clean Water Act by specific design.
Yeah, certainly in agriculture, to the extent that runoff is involved, enjoys the benefit of that exemption. Nobody else does, and there are a lot of other people who use fertilizer or other products out of doors, road salt. You've heard the examples that have been tossed about as people debated the implications of this decision, and they're being tossed about for good reason because there are any number of products that are used out of doors that ultimately and sometimes immediately after their use result in pollutants in the environment. Did Congress intend to reach back to the use, the release of all of those products into the environment as the point of discharge of a pollutant under the Clean Water Act? And I think that it didn't, but I certainly think that the plain language of the statute doesn't dictate that that be so. And that is why a formal rulemaking to the contrary is entitled to deference.
Right, but let's look again at the focus of the rule here at issue, and that is that it's discharges in, over, and near water. Sure, you can apply stuff anywhere over the land, and that eventually might run off into our streams and rivers and oceans is inevitable and is recognized, but then that becomes a non-point source. Here we have point sources dealing the chemicals. That was a Freudian slip, but a correct one. Dealing the chemicals into our nation's veins, that being our waterways. And that is something that can be stopped, and this court recognized it, and so did Congress.
Well, I want to quote you when I have to defend my first citizen suit against someone who used a product in the environment that ultimately ran off via stormwater into a waters. And I want to quote you that's not covered under this court's reasoning, because that's one of our greatest concerns. And I'm not, of course, as we said, agriculture enjoys the benefit of Congress anticipated this issue to some extent and protected that sector of the economy from regulation in that way. But for people who do not benefit, for other sectors or for individuals who don't benefit from that particular statutory exemption. I think that this court's reasoning creates a tremendous vulnerability that anything that is the but-for cause of pollutants in the environment, you reach back to the source. I fully expect to hear that argument. More importantly, the most interesting aspect of your reference to point sources dealing chemicals into our waterways is the use of the word chemicals rather than chemical waste. Congress did not enact a law to require federal permits for the point source discharge of chemicals into water, but instead for the point source discharge of chemical waste into waters. And you and I can debate all day the policy arguments for and against an onerous federal permitting regime for the use of chemical products in waters or over waters. But the only question before the Sixth Circuit is whether Congress unambiguously required federal permits for the use of chemicals in waters when it passed a law concerning only the point source discharge of chemical waste into waters. And if there is ambiguity in that statutory language on that point, the court's obligation is to defer to the agency's reasonable interpretation. Now, I submit that there is ambiguity, and if there weren't, someone, including most notably EPA, would have seen this requirement in the Clean Water Act 30 years ago.
Well, first of all, Ellen, the court, let me say, too, that I can only hope that my words are taken as binding precedent, but I expect my words won't carry that much weight. But more importantly, the court did make the distinction between chemicals and chemical waste, and it did so in the context of the definition of pollutant. And it did so very carefully and found that the definitions of chemical waste and biological materials were, in fact, unambiguous and need to be implemented, and that the EPA rule that that your clients petitioned for didn't meet the statutory requirements. So to continue to argue that the court missed that, I think, is incorrect. The court was very careful.
So I think we've had an interesting, exciting discussion and even debate on this topic. I'd ask the two panelists if they would want to add some closing remarks at this time. Ellen?
I guess I would just close, Doug, by saying that these are issues like this raise a number of interesting and topical and timely policy discussions about pollution in the environment and man's role and the balancing of human activity and the need for environmental protection. And as important as those debates are, what we have here is a legal question, ultimately, and a question that concerns Congress's intent in 1972 and the role of agencies and the role of the courts and the authority given to agencies to interpret and apply the laws enacted by Congress and to interpret and fill in the gaps where there is ambiguity in that law enacted by Congress. And ultimately what this comes down to is a question of whether the court accorded EPA here the power that an agency should have to fill gaps left in the statute by Congress, or whether the court filled those itself on the basis of general statutory policies. And I think that our position on that issue is pretty clear, and we have a difference of opinion.
Thank you. Charlie?
Yes, well, I think it's really important to note that this EPA, a more enlightened one, has recognized that the rule that was written a few years ago at the behest of the pesticide industry
was in fact inconsistent with the statute and has undertaken a permit process. And we hope that this the permits that result from EPA undertaking this process will be meaningful, will include a needs analysis, and only when need is shown that if the pesticides are indeed applied, that adequate monitoring to know what impacts are taking place will be essential requirements of the permit. For decades, pesticides have been applied under the guise of FIFRA registration without adequate accountability. It's time for that paradigm to change. And Ellen, I recognize that adopting such an approach will affect your clients' pocketbooks, but it will inure to the betterment of human health and overall environmental protection.
Thank you, Charlie. It's almost a set of topics for another debate that you've raised at the end there.
I just have to add in response to that, that my clients are the people who grow food for America's table, and there's a lot more than the pocketbooks of farmers that are going to be affected by this decision.
Well, it's not the pocketbooks of the farmers that I'm talking about. It's the pocketbooks of the pesticide manufacturers.
And those simply are not my clients, and you'll have to get their lawyer on the phone to talk about that.
Well, actually, Doug, thank you very much, because you are the representative for those guys, so he is on the phone.
And without our inputs, there wouldn't be food on the table, which is the bottom line in modern agriculture, that's for sure. And I think we could have, as I said, a whole other debate on that topic in terms of the amount of safety testing and the rest that EPA does to ensure that the products used on the crops are safe. But I think that probably strays from the Sixth Circuit decision that we were debating today. So I want to thank both panelists for a very lively and obviously energetic debate, especially at the end. I want to thank all of you listeners out there for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. And thank you again, everyone, for listening.